You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
They are values that we have come to associate very strongly with the pro-life movement. Freedom of speech. There have been court cases argued by pro-life groups and by Christian legal groups in favor of, say, your right to stand across the street from an abortion clinic with a sign, and that's not a threat. That is your right to speak, to public protest. That's a value that's strongly associated with pro-life groups. Was it always strongly associated with pro-life groups? If not, why not? And it really, if you stop and think about it, it's just a good old-fashioned, what we used to call a liberal value. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about liberal values in the pro-life movement. Dr. Andrew Lewis joins us on this Thursday afternoon. He's assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati, author of the book The Right's Turn in Conservative Christian Politics, and a recent op-ed column for the New York Times titled How the Pro-Life Movement Has Promoted Liberal Values. Dr. Lewis, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Is this a natural marriage, kind of the old school liberal values, what we used to associate with liberalism in terms of free speech, First Amendment kind of things, and the pro-life movement?
You know, I think there certainly are some tensions that develop between, you know, sort of what we think of as sort of expressive free speech kind of politics and a more conservative traditional sort of religion and politics. But also there are some natural things that go together when you start to think of sort of political activism, expressing views in public. Also, particularly when you start to think about the views of rights and defending the human rights of, particularly the rights of the unborn, that stream of rights consciousness that is a part of the pro-life movement. And that human rights element of the pro-life movement, that sort of language is very natural to liberalism. And so, I mean, that makes it, in some senses, a nice fit for elements of sort of classical liberal discussions.
As it actually worked itself out, was it always that way, where pro-lifers were embracing those values?
Well, it's sort of a nuanced history, I would say. In the middle part of the 20th century, some of the early pro-lifers were really committed to sort of human rights, universal human rights for the unborn. In fact, they were much more progressive and liberal in their orientations. They came out of sort of New Deal politics, and a lot of these were Catholics and more liberal Protestants. And as conservative Christians and evangelicals joined this movement after Roe versus Wade in the end of the 70s and early 80s, they actually brought with them some of the concerns about sort of sexual immorality and some of those sort of more moral concerns. And so they were less soaked in some of the liberal human rights elements of the pro-life cause, but there always remained a sort of stream of human rights vision to the pro-life movement. In fact, you know, like National Right to Life sort of was founded with that right to life language. And so over time, in many senses, this rights language, this rights cause became to sort of dominate the movement. By the end of the 80s, early 90s, it really was sort of the primary way that sort of anti-abortion pro-life discussions were argued in the public sphere. So there's a bit of a nuance. It starts with more of a human rights orientation. As evangelicals and conservative Christians joined the fold, they weren't as interested in they didn't use the rights liberal language as much, but then they adopted it later, and now pretty much everyone does.
Talk a little bit about something you point out in your op-ed piece in the New York Times, and that is that evangelicals attracted to the pro-life movement were kind of cautious at first.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Largely, the pro-life movement and opposition to abortion was seen as a Catholic movement predominantly, and evangelicals and Catholics, you know, they operate in different spheres. There was much more of a divide between Catholics and Protestants in the 60s and 70s, you know, so seen as a Catholic issue. They were slower to understand, I think, sort of how this fit into sort of Protestant theology. Protestants didn't have as much of a concern with contraception, and so they didn't have sort of a natural sort of theological frame for abortion. And so all of these are things, I think, made them a bit slower into coming along into the pro-life movement. But I think a good bit was sort of that it was primarily sort of a Catholic issue, and there was sort of this gulf between Catholics and Protestants at the time that sort of divided those two groups.
Talk about what effect perhaps the formation of Christian legal organizations that were concerned not only about life, but also about religious freedom, First Amendment issues. What role did that play in it?
Well, I think it's huge for how you start to think about strategies and tactics, and how in my piece, I start talking about how the cultivation of the valuing and expanding and promoting free speech and things like religious freedom and religious rights and religious advocacy, all of this really starts to develop. There's some early developments. It really starts to move really quickly in the late 80s, 90s, and early parts of the 2000s. A lot of this is directly connected to sort of pro-life groups, pro-life cases that get taken to the Supreme Court. And as these things get developed legally and legal challenges, these groups start looking for what are the best ways we can argue our cases to try to win, and what kind of Supreme Court precedents can we draw upon. And so these language of free speech rights and First Amendment rights and religious freedom rights and thinking about how that can best be argued both legally and politically, this gets filtered through legal organizations and political organizations. And I think it really has, over the last few decades, sort of crafted much more a rights-centric and a First Amendment-centric sort of conservative Christian politics.
You say the politics of abortion have been teaching conservative Christians about the value of free speech. What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the idea that free speech became really important for conservative Christians to protect what they thought was with their own message in the public square. And not only that, then they also came to realize that they should defend the sphere of free speech, not just for themselves, but also for others, so that they may also be protected. We should want to defend free speech for us, but also for our neighbor, who we may not necessarily always agree with, but we would like to defend our neighbor's speech because we don't want the neighbor's speech limited, lest someone else would limit our own speech. And so once you're engaged in that sort of mindset, you become much more of a liberal free speech protector, a free speech thinker. And this is sort of classic sort of liberal individual rights constitutional approach that was very prominent in the 60s and 70s that conservatives would not have liked a lot of the free speech decisions that would have come out of those decisions in the 1960s and 70s. But now you see conservatives defending this brand of sort of unfettered free speech in order to protect things like religious groups or pro-life groups or things like that. And so all in all, I would say that anti-abortion advocacy has sort of taught conservative Christians the value of sort of free speech in the public square, especially as they have become more of a cultural minority in politics.
Has there been a concurrent contraction of classical liberal values in the pro-abortion movement that you can see?
Sometimes you see some Supreme Court cases where, particularly on the other, like the other side, will argue for some times where they need to limit free speech. And in fact, you even had some times when the ACLU, some branches of the ACLU had actually joined forces with some of the pro-life movement and saying, like, no, these buffer zones are too limiting on free speech, for example, outside of hospitals or Planned Parenthood clinics and things like that. And so you have seen a bit of sort of flip-flopping where sort of liberals, in some cases, the liberals had argued for more limits on speech and the conservative Christian groups that argued for more expansion on speech. I haven't done fully the full-scale analysis of all of the pro-abortion arguments to make full justifications on that side, but I would just make a statement that politics make sort of strange bedfellows, it seems, and legal politics and those kind of things. So you do find some interesting cases and interesting arguments that have developed over time. In general, everyone has become more tolerant of free speech in the last 30 years, but conservative Christians have become much more tolerant, though they started from a lower position.
Do you think that the acceptance of and then the embrace of classical liberal values, free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, thought, has strengthened the pro-life movement?
Well, I think there's no doubt that it has strengthened it legally and politically. I think it's put it on a much stronger legal and political ground. It has provided it with a much more of a prominent public access. It also has helped give sort of a non-religious political participation language, a language that we can participate in public on equal grounds because we are engaging, we have the right to participate in these things just like others. And so it's this sort of equal access to sort of public sphere, public arguments. Those kinds of language, I think, have helped maintain the status as not being relegated to just sort of a religious view, but also sort of a competing political and legal view that has just allowed it to not be sort of segmented off, but just to be sort of a strongly competing political force in America. I mean, you see a lot of conservative religious views that have waned in support in the last few decades, but pro-life views have remained stable. In fact, perhaps slightly grown over time. And so I would say framing them in the language of rights has been part of the reason that they publicly have been more successful.
I'm thinking about Richard John Neuhaus, who near the end of his life was fond of saying that abortion was the human rights and civil rights issue of this generation.
Right.
To me, that seems to be a broad view that abortion fits in with those rights and is natural there. What do you think of his statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, he was one of these that comes from more of the liberal civil rights and human rights tradition and would have seen abortion in those terms and in those language, and so it's a natural fit for him. And I think the reframing of abortion like that allows the acceptance and understanding many people to grab hold of that. And so when the other side would say, no, we have a rights argument for choice or for privacy, then the pro-life argument would say, no, but we have our own, we're just standing up for the rights of the unborn. And this is, these competing rights, I think, allow for the stability of the pro-life argument in the face of a liberal rights claim, which I think is really potent to the success of the pro-life movement over time, unlike sort of just a religious argument, which many in the public sphere would say is, you know, these aren't really very good arguments, good public arguments in some sense. So I largely think that that's a really insightful take that he has about this issue.
Dr. Andrew Lewis is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati, author of the book, The Right to Turn in Conservative Christian Politics, and a recent op-ed column for the New York Times titled How the Pro-Life Movement Has Promoted Liberal Values. You can read it and find out more about his book at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Lewis, I understand you are a native of Troy, Illinois. Is there anyone you'd like to say hello to?
Well, my parents, Tim and Christy, still live there in Troy, and my brother Brad and his wife Erin. So if they're there and Troy, tell them hello. I get back occasionally.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed the conversation.
The preeminent pro-life apologist and advocate Scott Klusendorf is going to be making the case for life, speaking at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. As I said, he'll be making the case for life. Early bird registration is $110 before March 1st. You can find out more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call during regular business hours, 618-223-8385. It's the premier conference for Christian laity, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series on the Lutheran Confessions, talking with Pastor Paul McCain about the doctrine of justification. We will discuss using the wrong measurements when assessing the success of school and education with Dr. Thomas Korchak, and we'll talk with Dr. Gregory Schultz about utilitarianism. He says it's an ethic that isn't even ethical. It's more like hedonism, he says. We'll talk more about that tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.